everyone. My name is Mike DeBliss. I am going to be presenting on the topic of evidence today. I call this presentation Evidence 101. Just a little bit about me. I am a trial lawyer. I started out as a public defender in the New Jersey Office of the Public Defender. I spent about 7 or 8 years there. And when I left, I continued to do work for the Public Defender's Office and grew my private practice to include a lot of white-collar criminal defense work. So I've been in state courts, I've been in federal courts, and these days I've also been branching out into civil work as well. So I do have a lot of experience as a trial lawyer, and this is one of my favorite topics. And one that I really ate up as a law student. And I feel every year, as the years go on, I feel as though my understanding of evidence goes deeper. But the deeper it goes, the more I realize how much I have yet to learn, because the issues are so broad and there's always new and complex fact patterns that emerge in this field. So I'm always thirsty for learning, and you know, I feel like I'm that my presentation evolves and changes as the years go by. The way I view evidence, I start out with three major areas. This is the way I like to see the way I like to view evidence. I see the three major areas as being relevance, the second main area being witnesses, and the third main area being hearsay. When it comes to relevance, the first question that I ask myself is, how is this evidence relevant? And I'll get into that a little deeper. The second issue is the one involving witnesses. And when I speak of witnesses, I'm referring to testimonial evidence that includes form of examination, opinions and experts, and finally, credibility and impeachment. And the third major area, of course, is hearsay. I also have a catch-all area of coverage that I colloquially refer to as digressions. And I basically break digressions down into two subgroups, writings and privileges. So let's begin with relevance. I think a good place to start when it comes to relevance is to go over Federal Rule of Evidence 401. That's a rule that you know, we've heard many a time when we were law students, and that we continue to hear as practicing attorneys. Relevant evidence is evidence which has the tendency to make the existence of any fact that is of consequence to the determination of the action more probable or less probable than it would be without the evidence. Now, when it's a mouthful, and I feel that sometimes it's very easy to speed through this definition without breaking it down into smaller subsections so that we can actually understand what certain phrases mean. It's almost like a long sausage that you know, needs to be chopped into smaller pieces so that you know, they can be put on a sandwich. So I like to begin by looking at two strands of the definition. The first is the relevancy strand, and the second is the materiality strand. The relevancy strand is very simply that part of the rule that states tendency to make the existence of any fact more or less probable than it would be without such fact. The materiality strand is that part of the rule that states that the fact must be of consequence to the determination of the action. Now, there's a distinction between direct evidence and circumstantial evidence. And while it seems very basic and rudimentary, I think it's oftentimes a good practice to just go back and make sure that we have some basic working knowledge of the difference between the two. We're talking about logical relevancy, and logical relevancy problems involve only circumstantial evidence, not direct evidence. That's why it's very important to have a concrete to have concrete examples of what we're referring to when we speak of direct evidence and then when we speak of circumstantial evidence. So direct evidence is that which does not depend on any inference for its relevancy. For example, testimony of an eyewitness to a shooting that the witness saw the accused shoot the victim. There's no inference required there. The eyewitness actually saw the event. She saw the accused shoot the victim. So this is what's referred to as direct evidence. It was observed firsthand by the witness, and now it's being testified to by the witness at trial. By contrast, circumstantial evidence is evidence whose relevancy depends on the drawing of an inference. I hate to use a tired out, hackneyed example, but the one that is given a lot in courtrooms by judges is the one involving the snow. You go to sleep when it's laid out at night in the middle of the winter and there's no snow on the ground. You wake up in the morning several hours later, and then you see a beautiful coating of white snow on the ground. You weren't awake to witness the snow actually fall, but you can make an inference and assume that there was a snowfall between the time you went to sleep and the time you woke up in the morning. So that's one example of circumstantial evidence. It's evidence whose relevancy depends on the drawing of an inference. In that example, the inference is the falling of the snow that you did not witness firsthand, but that had to have happened in order for your streets and your sidewalk and your front yard to be covered with white snow. Another example is testimony of an eyewitness. If we're continuing with the example that I gave earlier, testimony of an eyewitness that she did not see the actual shooting, but that she saw the accused running from the scene of the crime. The difference between the last example and this one is that in the last example, the eyewitness actually saw the shooting. Here, she didn't see the shooting, but she saw a suspect run from the scene of the crime. Now, when it comes to relevance, as I alluded to earlier, there's two types. The first type is logical relevance, and the second type is discretionary, pragmatic, or policy-based relevance. Let's talk about logical relevance first. Logical relevance is evidence that has any tendency to make a material fact more probable or less probable than it would be without the evidence. It's an easy standard. However, there are some traps that you can fall into here. And so what I like to do when I'm looking at logical relevance is I like to identify the warning signals. And by warning signals, I'm referring to the fact that evidence may not be logically relevant if evidence involves some other time, event, or person than the one involved in the litigation. So those are some things you want to look out for, because, as I said, those are signals that the evidence may not be logically relevant if, again, the evidence involves some other time, event, or person than the one involved in litigation. Discretionary or policy-based relevance is a much stricter standard of admissibility. Even relevant evidence may be excluded if its probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of, and then we have the laundry list of things that we are taught to rely upon as a way of getting relevant evidence excluded. And that list consists of unfair prejudice, confusion of issues, misleading the jury, undue delay, waste of time, and cumulative evidence. One of the things you want to look out for when it comes to Federal Rule of Evidence 403, which basically lists this laundry list of exclusions, it makes no mention of unfair surprise. So the least likely ground to exclude logically relevant evidence is unfair surprise, for the reason I just stated. It's no ground for the exclusion of logically relevant evidence. Now, we have some recurring relevance patterns, specific problems involving logical relevancy. There are also discretionary policy-based relevance recurring patterns. So let's look at some specific problems involving logical relevancy. The first that I identify is the one involving similar occurrences. What I mean by similar occurrences are scenarios or situations where the evidence is admissible even though it is not, even though it does involve some other time, some other event, or some other person not directly involved in litigation. And usually these types are causation problems to prove cause and effect. So here's a quick and dirty example to basically explain this. Let's suppose that the plaintiff eats at a restaurant and gets sick. The plaintiff suspects that it was the hamburger that he ate at McDonald's that made him nauseous. How can the plaintiff prove that the hamburger meat served at McDonald's was bad? Well, one way the plaintiff can do that is by offering evidence that on the day in question when he got sick from the hamburger meat at McDonald's, he was eating there with three of his friends, and they ate the same type of food, hamburger, the hamburger that he had. And as I said, it was at the same time and at the same restaurant. So the fact that three of his friends ate the same type of food at the same time and at the same restaurant and also got sick would be admissible to prove cause and effect. So again, this falls under the fact pattern of similar occurrences where the evidence is admissible even though it does involve some other time, some other event, or some other person not directly involved in the litigation. But again, I stress here that we were able to establish here that the three friends that accompanied the plaintiff to McDonald's ate the same food at the same time and obviously were at the same restaurant and also got sick. So those are the conditions that would have to be proved in order for the evidence of the three other friends getting sick to be admissible. We have also prior accidents or claims. And here I refer to these fact patterns of similar accidents. They're basically what I'm talking about here is are situations where evidence of other prior accidents may be admissible by a plaintiff, first, to prove that a dangerous situation existed, or second, to prove that the defendant was aware of a dangerous condition if the plaintiff can establish a substantial identity of material circumstances. So the issue becomes whether there was a substantial identity of material circumstances. Let's take a look at an example. The plaintiff is offering evidence of three other accidents at a particular railroad crossing to show the dangerous nature of the crossing and that the city was on notice of how treacherous this crossing was. Would this evidence be admissible? Well, unfortunately, there's not a quick and dirty yes or no answer. It depends on whether or not there was a substantial identity of material circumstances. And by that, I mean that the plaintiff would have to show similar time of day, similar speed, similar weather condition. So the plaintiff cannot just arbitrarily offer evidence that there were three other accidents at a particular railroad crossing to show the dangerous nature of the crossing without being able to prove that those other accidents occurred at a similar time of day, at a similar speed, and when there were similar weather conditions, as was the accident that the plaintiff was involved in. So there has to be those similarities in order for those other accidents to be admitted as evidence. Now, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Can the absence of similar accidents be admissible by the defense? Well, courts are generally reluctant to admit such evidence. The situation in this scenario is that the defendant and not the plaintiff is offering evidence of absence of similar accidents to establish due care. The question that comes up in these situations is what evidence is required for absence of similar accidents to be admissible? Well, there are two conditions that must be satisfied. First, there must be a substantial identity of material circumstances. And second, the defendant must be able to show that if an accident had occurred, it would have been observed. So let's take a look at an example here. The plaintiff is suing the city after an accident at an intersection. The defendant offers to prove that over the last 14 years, the intersection has remained the same and there have been no reported accidents. Is that admissible? Yes. First, the intersection has remained the same. So that was one of the key facts in the scenario, that the intersection had remained the same and there had been no reported accidents. So the evidence would be admissible, first, because the intersection has remained the same for the last 14 years. That proves a substantial identity of material circumstances. And second, no accidents have been reported. Let's take a look at another example. The plaintiff slips and falls on a freshly waxed tile floor in a hotel lobby. The defendant is offering evidence that over the last week, over 1,500 people have used that floor, meaning they traipsed over that floor, and not one of them has fallen and gotten hurt. Is that evidence by defendant admissible to establish due care on the hotel's part? The very simple answer is no. Why? Well, because of one key fact. In the case of the plaintiff's fall, the floor had been freshly waxed. Obviously, it couldn't have been freshly waxed at the point in time when each and every one of those 1,500 other people walked across it. There is no substantial identity of material fact, and therefore the evidence would be inadmissible. So again, you have to be very, you have to tune in and be very focused on the fact pattern, and specifically the nature of the potential negligence. As I said in this example, the plaintiff who was walking into the hotel fell on a freshly waxed tile floor, and the defendant, the hotel, wants to offer evidence that no one has gotten hurt. Not one of the other 1,500 people that have traipsed over that floor have fallen and gotten hurt. Well, again, the plaintiff's fall occurred on the day that the floor had been waxed. We can't assume that when all of those other 1,500 people walked across the hotel floor, that the floor had also been waxed. It's more likely that the floor hadn't been waxed. And so the evidence of those 1,500 other people safely walked across the floor would not be admissible in light of the lack of the floor being waxed when that happened. So there's a general rule when it comes to these problems involving logical relevancy. Plaintiff's prior accidents or claims are not admissible. But like every rule in evidence, there are exceptions. Here's an example. The plaintiff drives into a bridge abutment and sues the city that built and maintained the bridge. The defendant, which is the city, now seeks to show that the plaintiff has on four prior occasions driven into stationary objects and sued. Is it admissible? Well, at first blush, you might say, yes, it is. But if we go by the general rule that was laid out earlier, that the plaintiff's prior accidents or claims are not admissible, the simple answer is no. The defendant city's application to introduce evidence of plaintiff's four other occasions driven that he drove into stationary objects and sued, but not be admissible. Why? Well, because it proves that plaintiff is accident prone, but that kind of character evidence is not admissible to prove conduct. Now, here are the exceptions. The first exception to this general rule that the plaintiff's prior accidents or claims are not admissible is to show common plan or scheme of fraud. The second exception is when the prior accidents are relevant on the issue of damages to the plaintiff. So let's go back to the first exception, to show common plan or scheme of fraud. And let's view that in the context of the hypo that I just discussed. Let's suppose that the city can show that the plaintiff's prior claims were fraudulent. Does that change the result? Would that change the judge's ruling that those four other occasions that the plaintiff drove into stationary objects and sued, would that be admissible if the city could show that those prior claims were fraudulent? Yes, that changes the admissibility of those four other occasions, and they would, in fact, be admissible if the city could show that those prior claims were fraudulent, because then the city's argument would become one of this evidence of the plaintiff's four prior accidents shows a common plan or scheme of fraud. And again, the city must show that those prior claims made by the plaintiff of driving into the bridge abutment were fraudulent. Then and only then would the evidence of those four prior incidents be admissible to show a common plan or scheme of fraud. Now for the second exception, when the prior accidents are relevant on the issue of damages to the plaintiff. What I mean here is that if the plaintiff is claiming an injury to the same part of his body that he previously injured, that would be admissible. So in our example, where the plaintiff drove into the bridge abutment and sued the city, if the plaintiff is alleging, let's say that the plaintiff is alleging that he separated his shoulder in the accident, in the collision, in the current collision, with the bridge abutment. If the defense can show that on those four other occasions that the plaintiff drove into the stationary object, the bridge, and sued, that the plaintiff's injury was to the same part of the body that he's claiming an injury to now, namely a separated shoulder, then those other occasions that he drove into the stationary object and sued would be admissible. Again, it would be admissible on the issue of damages to the plaintiff. And the rule here is that the plaintiff must claim an injury to the same part of his body that he previously injured in one of those earlier accidents. Then it's admissible. Intent or state of mind in issue. That is also a common fact pattern that comes up in problems involving logical relevancy. What I mean here by intent or state of mind in issue is to infer intent from prior conduct. So you can determine a person's state of mind through their conduct. Because as I would say this to my clients, and as I do say this to my clients, there is a specific intent requirement when it comes to the state proving criminal statutes and proving criminal cases. But because it's impossible to open up a person's head and determine what they were thinking at the point in time when they committed the criminal act, the state turns to the conduct of the person. What instances of conduct, what behaviors were exuded by the defendant at the time of the alleged offense. And by looking at the conduct and the behavior of the defendant, the state is then able to is then able to make arguments that the defendant's mens rea or the defendant's intent was very clearly to commit fraud or to commit theft or to injure or to maim. And so again, it's impossible to open up a person's head, but when you look at their conduct and their behavior, those tend to prove circumstantially the defendant's intent. It's no different here in the civil context. Here's a hypothetical. The plaintiff sues the defendant claiming a pattern of gender discrimination in hiring. Of course, the defendant employer denies any intent to discriminate and claims in this situation that the absence of women employees is because no women applicants were qualified. Well, this of course is a very righteous claim, and you know, one that you could anticipate a defendant employer making in the wake of a lawsuit for gender discrimination in hiring. Well, what can the plaintiff do here? The plaintiff is now offering evidence to show that other well-qualified women applied and yet were denied employment by the employer. Is that admissible? Yes. It's admissible to show how the defendant treated other qualified women who applied. So we have an allegation of a pattern of gender discrimination. We have an outright denial by the employer of any intent to discriminate, and a claim that the absence of women employees was simply because no women applicants were qualified. And now the plaintiff, who has the burden of proving an intent to discriminate, is offering evidence to show that there were in fact other well-qualified women who not only applied but were denied employment. And again, that is admissible to show the defendant's state of mind. Again, you can't get inside the defendant's head, so what we're referring or relying upon right now is prior conduct. And to prove prior conduct, we go back and we look at the defendant's track record, and we look at other examples of how he treated well-qualified women who applied. And in this instance, we're able to uncover evidence that showed that there were well-qualified women who applied and yet were denied employment. That would be admissible to prove that or to show how the defendant treated other qualified women who applied. We also have rebuttal evidence. By rebuttal evidence, I'm referring to rebutting the defense of impossibility. So in this hypothetical, we have a plaintiff who purchases a can of Coke, and as he's drinking the can of Coke, he feels something that he ingests something that he was not expecting. It happens to be a furry mouse, and he subsequently sues the defendant Bodler. The defendant turns around and defends on the ground that it's impossible for a mouse to get into a can of Coke. The plaintiff then turns around and offers evidence of another recent incident in which a mouse was found in a Coke bottle. Is it admissible? Yes. You know, and not to sugarcoat this or make fun of it or mock it, but the first time might have been a coincidence, but not a different mouse on a different day. So as we can see here, the defense is alleging an impossibility defense, which is completely eviscerated by the argument that this has happened once before. And, you know, if it were happening the first time, it might have been a coincidence, but the fact that it's happened once before, and that there's now it's a different mouse on a different day, you know, it puts a gut or puts a wrench in any defense of impossibility. There's also, when it comes to specific problems involving logical relevancy, a fact pattern of comparable sales to establish value. The sale price of other items or chattels or parcels of real property are admissible if they are of the same type. That second, those other sales took place at about the same time period. And third, those other sales took place in the same general geographical area. So here's an example. A prior sale of land can be used circumstantially to prove the value of an existing piece of property if there was a substantial identity of material circumstance. And in a fact pattern involving real property, what we'd be talking about here is similar location, similar size, similar condition, or I should say, even when we're talking about a chattel, you know, a piece of a tangible property. So let's say we're dealing with the sale of unique property, a Picasso painting. Expert testimony would be required to show similarity of value. But the main thing is the similarity of location, the similarity in size, and the similarity in condition. Habit evidence. We can't talk about logical relevancy without a discussion of habit evidence. What we're talking about here when we talk about habit evidence is the habit of a person to act in a certain way. That's relevant to show that a person acted in the same way on the occasion in question. So the definition of habit evidence is evidence of the habit of a person or the routine practice of an organization is relevant to prove conduct that conforms with the habit or the routine practice, regardless of whether it's been corroborated or not, and regardless of the presence of eyewitnesses. So we have some overlapping rules here. We have disposition evidence to infer conduct on a certain occasion is not admissible. Then we have prior act evidence to infer conduct on the occasion in question is not admissible. Then we have habit evidence is admissible. Once again, the habit of a person is admissible to infer that a person acted consistently with that conduct on a particular occasion. So one of the things that I think is sometimes helpful is distinguishing between character evidence and habit evidence. Character evidence is a generalized description of a person's disposition. Habit, on the other hand, and I'm sorry to beat a dead horse here, but it is, like I said, very important to distinguish these two. Habit evidence is circumstantial evidence of a person's regular response to a repeated specific situation. When you hear those words, it's almost the vision that I get in my mind is almost that of my dog. When I get ready to feed her in the morning or at night, as soon as I put the dog food in her bowl and put it on the floor, I get the same response. She comes running right over to me, sits down, and begins salivating and wagging her tail. That conduct is a repeated, specific conduct that I can count on over 99.9% of the time when I feed her. So when it comes to habit evidence, we're looking for words such as always, automatically, invariably, regularly, instinctively, and without fail. These are tip-offs that we have a habit evidence fact pattern. Now, if you see words such as frequently and often, those terms are not enough. They need to be stronger terms. Again, we're looking for always, automatically, invariably, regularly, instinctively, and without fail. Here's an example. A passenger is suing the driver after a car accident. The driver's eyewitness testifies that the passenger was not wearing her seatbelt. The passenger calls Wanda as a witness to testify that she drives to work every day with a passenger and has done so for the last 3 years, and invariably the passenger wears her seatbelt. Is that evidence going to be admissible habit evidence at trial? Yes. That testimony given by Wanda, the witness, that the plaintiff invariably wears her seatbelt will be admissible habit evidence. Here's another hypo. There's an accident at an intersection, and the issue at trial becomes whether the defendant stopped at the stop sign. The defendant offers a witness to testify that the defendant, one, is a cautious driver, two, that the witness had seen the defendant stop at that stop sign on two other occasions, and three, that the witness had seen the defendant stop at that stop sign on 10 or 20 prior occasions. Which of those options is most likely to be admitted? One, that he's a cautious driver, two, that the witness has seen him stop at the stop sign on two other occasions, or three, that the witness has seen the defendant stop at that stop sign on 10 or 20 prior occasions. If you chose the third choice, you would be correct. If the defendant has stopped at the stop sign on 10 or 20 prior occasions, that's probably enough to make it habit. Now, what is the consequence of introducing habit evidence? Well, at the time of the accident, even if there were no eyewitnesses, habit evidence is admissible to show that the defendant stopped at the stop sign. And that's huge, because in this trial, the whole case comes down to whether the defendant stopped at the stop sign. And so it doesn't matter that the plaintiff might be arguing that the defendant didn't stop at the stop sign. It doesn't matter that there were no witnesses to see whether the defendant stopped at the stop sign. If the witnesses, if that witness's testimony that she saw the defendant stop at the stop sign on 10 or 20 prior occasions is admissible, then that comes into evidence. And that evidence, as being habit evidence, is admissible to show that the defendant stopped at the stop sign on the day in question. So that's huge. And that's why habit evidence can not be overlooked, because in a case like this, it could win the case for the defendant by proving that he, in fact, stopped at the stop sign, even though there were no witnesses at the scene at the time of the accident to corroborate it. Now, habit evidence may be proved either by opinion testimony or by evidence of specific instances of conduct. There are a few other problems involving logical relevancy that bring up this issue of business routine. By business routine, I'm referring to the routine practice of an organization, and it's admissible just like habit evidence. So the normal business routine of a business is admissible to show that the business acted consistently or in conformity with that business routine on a given occasion. An example might be evidence of the routine by which a company answers phone orders and closes certain order forms in an envelope and then mails them out using FedEx. Any one of those would be admissible as a routine business practice of a corporation such as the Home Shopping Network. Industrial or trade custom is admissible as non-conclusive evidence of standard of care. What we're interested in is what others in the same business or trade have done in the past as an indication of what these parties should have done. So let's say that Mike tries to get off of the bus, but the driver closes the door on Mike's foot and drags him for several blocks. I realize that that's a pretty graphic example. Later on, Mike sues the bus company, alleging negligence for failing to install a safety device that would prevent the bus from moving when the passenger doors open. The bus company offers to show that no other bus company employs such a device. Is it admissible? Yes, it is admissible. Again, what we're interested in when it comes to industrial or trade custom is what others in the same business or trade have done in the past as an indication of what this company should have done in this situation. So again, Mike is suing the bus company for failing to have installed this safety device that would have prevented the bus from moving with the passenger door slightly ajar with his foot in it. But again, the bus company can offer evidence to show that no other bus company employs such a device. Now, if other bus companies did in fact employ such a device, the fact that this bus company didn't would not allow them to introduce the evidence that the other bus companies didn't employ the advice. If the other bus companies actually employed the device, then this bus company obviously wouldn't be interested in introducing that evidence. But nonetheless, it's important to note here that the bus company that's being sued can only rely on what these other bus companies have done if it squares with their theory of the defense. So the fact that these other bus companies don't employ a safety device that would stop the bus from moving if the door were open, that would be admissible to refute the negligence claim that they failed to install a safety device. Now, what if Michael was able to show that 98% of the other bus companies do have the device? So it's interesting here because what's good for the goose is good for the gander. In the first scenario, the bus company is seeking to introduce evidence that these other bus companies don't use any type of device that would stop their buses from moving if the door were open. And they are able to introduce that evidence under this industrial or trade custom rule. Now, Michael, as the plaintiff, is wanting to show that 98% of other bus companies do have this device. And is it admissible? Yes. Once again, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Michael can use evidence that 98% of these other companies do have the device to prove that the bus company that is the defendant in this case should have had a safety device. Is it conclusive on the liability issue? Maybe not. I apologize, I don't have more of a concrete answer, but I would say here, my answer to that would be no. It's not conclusive on the liability issue. And the reason why is because maybe the 98% of those other bus companies that do have a safety device are acting out of an abundance of caution. And that might not be customary in the industry for buses to have an interlocking door device. So let me backtrack here because I misspoke earlier when I said that if Michael was able to show that 98% of the other bus companies do have the device, that would be relevant to prove that this bus company...
Esquire CLE's first verification code is FAN, F-A-N, all lowercase, FAN. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's first verification code is FAN, F-A-N, all lowercase, FAN. Please take a moment and write this down.
Should have had the device. It's not conclusive on a liability issue, so I do apologize. And, my personal opinion here is that there could still be further arguments made by the defense. And even if 98% of these other bus companies have the safety device, the defense in this case could argue that, they do, 98% of these other companies do have it, but they are acting out of a abundance of caution. And that is not customary in the industry for the buses to have an interlocking door device. And so it would not be dispositive or conclusive on the liability issue. Now we're going to move into discretionary policy-based relevance. Here, there's three areas of importance. There's liability insurance, then there's subsequent remedial measures, and then finally, there are settlements. Let's first talk about liability insurance. The general rule when it comes to liability insurance is that evidence that a person was or was not insured at the time of an accident is not admissible to show that the person acted negligently or wrongfully, or to show ability to pay. There are some exceptions. It's admissible when relevant to show ownership or control. So a quick and dirty example here would be if a defendant denies ownership of a building where the plaintiff was injured. If the plaintiff offers to show that the defendant carries liability insurance on the building, then that would be admissible. Again, the defendant put the issue into dispute by denying ownership of the building. So the plaintiff here is offering evidence of the defendant carrying liability insurance on the building to prove that the defendant, in fact, was the owner of the building. And to that extent, it's admissible. Second, the second exception is to impeach the credibility of a witness by showing interest or bias. So in this hypothetical, the witness testifies favorably for defendant to facts of the accident. The plaintiff subsequently offers to show that the witness is the claims manager of the defendant's liability insurance company, the same company that would otherwise have to pay if the defendant is found liable. Is that admissible? Yes. The fact that the defendant carries liability insurance and that the witness is the claims manager of the very same liability insurance company that would have to pay if the defendant is found liable would be admissible to show that the witness is biased. This witness is employed by the insurance company, the defendant's insurance company, which is the real party in interest. Indeed, the insurance company will have to pay if the defendant is found liable. Therefore, this witness is interested in giving this kind of testimony. The next exception is statements made in connection with ownership of liability insurance. Those would be admissible. And there's a severance issue that comes up here. So let me give you an example. The defendant goes over to the plaintiff and says, quote, "I ran the red light, but don't worry, my insurance will pay for it." What I like to do here is separate these two or bifurcate this fact pattern by first looking at the red light, the admission that the defendant makes to the plaintiff that I ran the red light. Then I like to look at the second half of the statement, "Don't worry, my insurance will pay for it," separately. So let's first look at the first clause, "I ran the red light." Is that admissible? No. Under 411, statements made in connection with ownership of liability insurance are inadmissible. Now, I'm going to just, okay, I'm sorry, I skipped here. The first part of that fact pattern, "I ran the red light," the admission of running the red light is not admissible. And the second part, "but don't worry, my insurance will pay for it." Under 411, statements made in connection with ownership of liability insurance are inadmissible. So the second half would be inadmissible. Subsequent remedial measures. Subsequent remedial measures are not admissible to show negligence, culpable conduct, a defect in a product, a defect in a product's design, or a need for a warning or instruction. We have a rationale, and I find it helpful sometimes if we know what the rationale behind some of these rules are. The rationale is that we want to encourage businesses to make repairs after an accident without fear of retaliation later in court by use of this evidence. If we use this information against the defendant will be dissuaded from making subsequent remedial measures. So an example here is one involving evidence that the defendant installed new brake linings in his truck after an accident, which was caused by faulty brakes. Now, if we were to try to introduce evidence that the defendant installed these new brake linings in his truck after the accident, which was caused by the faulty brakes, it would be inadmissible to prove negligence. Why? Well, it's a subsequent remedial repair that the defendant took, installing these new brake linings, and it would be inadmissible under 407. In this next example, we have a product liability action against a tractor manufacturer. The plaintiff is introducing evidence that the defendant corporation changed the design of its tractor 3 months after the plaintiff was injured. Is that admissible? No, it's inadmissible under the general prohibition. The fact that in a product liability action, the tractor manufacturer changed the design of the product is inadmissible. We do have some exceptions here. There's an exception to show ownership and control. So again, the scenario I gave you earlier, where the plaintiff is suing a building owner and the defendant denies ownership of the building, but the plaintiff offers evidence to show that, this is slightly different. We have a scenario here where a defendant is denying ownership of a building where the plaintiff was injured. This is a slight variation from the earlier one, I apologize. The plaintiff is now offering evidence to show that the defendant made repairs to the building. Would that be admissible on the issue of ownership? Yes. Once again, the defendant has injected this issue of ownership into the case by flatly denying ownership of the building. So the plaintiff is now able to offer evidence to show that the defendant made repairs to the building to show that he had either ownership or control of it. Here's another example. The defendant cuts down a rotted tree after one of its branches broke off and fell on the plaintiff and injured him. This evidence would be admissible to show ownership and control if the defendant first claimed that the tree was on city property. So once again, there's a cadence or a dance that takes place here. Before, the plaintiff could introduce evidence that the defendant cut down the rotted tree, the defense would first have to claim that the tree was on city property and that it didn't belong to him. So if the defendant first injected the issue of the tree not being his problem because it was on city property, then the plaintiff could introduce evidence that the defendant cut down a rotted tree, and that would be relevant on the issue of ownership of the tree because the defendant has initiated this ownership issue or put it into dispute by denying ownership of the tree and claiming that it was on city property. The plaintiff can offer evidence that a week later the defendant cut that tree down. This is a subsequent remedial measure, and it would be admissible to show ownership or control that the tree was on the defendant's property and not on the city's property. Now, impeachment. When I talk about impeachment here, what I want you to do is be on the lookout for a statement where the defendant denies the feasibility of precautionary measures, followed by that same defendant taking subsequent remedial measures to repair. Some of the catchphrases that you might want to look for here is, there's no way I could have made this product any safer. Another one is, there's no alternative design that would have made the product or premises safer. So let's take a look at an example. The plaintiff walks into a glass door that is practically invisible. The defendant counters that there was and is no way to avoid such an accident. So what the defendant has done here is essentially deny the feasibility of precautionary measures. That's what I'm referring to here by this idea that the defendant is throwing up his arms and saying, there's nothing I could have done better to have avoided or prevented this accident. The plaintiff now turns around and offers evidence to show that after the accident, the defendant put red little sticky notes on the door in order to make the glass more visible. Is that admissible? Absolutely. And the argument might go like this. In the 6 months prior to the plaintiff's injury, how many other customers walked into the glass door? And the answer to that, you know, it might have been no, that, you know, in the 6 months prior to the plaintiff's accident, no other customers walked into the glass door. Or the answer could have been that there were more than one person that walked into the glass door. And then the subsequent follow-up question would be, how many customers walked into the glass door after the plaintiff ran into it? And the answer, you know, might be none. So obviously we have a favorable answer to the first question about how many other customers walked into the glass door before the plaintiff did, if the answer was more than one. And if the answer to the subsequent question was how many customers walked into the glass door after the plaintiff ran into it, none. You know, and then you would ask, is that because you took it upon yourself to place these red stickers on the door and make them more visible? So there's ways that you could cross-examine the defendant building owner to establish that that there were precautionary measures that could have been made to stop or to avoid the accident. In fact, you know, at the end of the day, the fact that the defendant put the stickers on the door after the plaintiff's accident is more than enough to establish that there were precautionary measures that could have avoided this accident. So you don't necessarily have to establish that there were any customers before the plaintiff walked into the door that ran into that same door. It's enough to show that the defendant took precautionary measures by placing these stickers on the door after the accident to prove that there were, in fact, feasibility or that there was, in fact, precautionary measures that could have been made to avoid this accident. Settlements. An offer to settle a claim which is disputed is inadmissible to prove liability for the claim or its amount. It's important here to note that there must be an actual dispute before settlement negotiations may take place. The rationale here is to encourage out-of-court settlement through settlement talks. And I mean, if you think about this on a very practical level, I mean, this would put an end to all settlement discussions if they were admissible to prove liability. So if you were a defense attorney in a civil action and the plaintiff's attorney were picked up the phone and wanted to talk about a possible settlement, if you as a defense attorney knew that these settlement negotiations could later be used to prove liability on the behalf of your client if the case didn't resolve, then you would have no incentive at all And you would have no, and ethically, you would not even touch a settlement negotiation with a 10-foot pole for fear that if the settlement negotiations broke down, that any admission or even tacit or tacit admission during the course of these settlement negotiations could later be used to prove liability on the behalf of your client. So again, the rationale here is to encourage out-of-court settlement through settlement talks. It includes not only the actual settlement, but also the offer to settle. It's a broad rule of exclusion that covers actual compromises, offers to compromise, offers to plead guilty in a criminal case, withdrawn pleas of guilty, and pleas of nolo contendere. And especially in the criminal context, I mean, the whole courts would become backed up if discussions during plea negotiations could later be used to prove a defendant's guilt those settlement negotiations broke down and the case went to trial. It would literally grind the criminal courts to a screeching halt. So this is why these types of negotiations are inadmissible. Admissions of fact, liability, or damage made in the course of an offer to compromise a claim disputed as to liability or as to amount are not admissible. There are some limitations here. For the rule of exclusion to operate, there must be a claim. So what I mean here is that by a claim is that the plaintiff is suing. Let me give you this example. Plaintiff is suing the defendant after a car accident. The defendant comes over to the plaintiff and says, quote, "I'll offer you $1,000 to settle this matter. Is that admissible?" No. And why? Well, it's an offer to settle, and under the general rule, it is inadmissible. So once again, admissions of fact, liability, or damage made in the course of an offer to compromise a claim disputed as to liability or as to amount are not admissible. And once again, for the rule of exclusion to operate, there must be a claim. And in this example, we have plaintiff who is suing the defendant after a car accident. So this is not a situation where the cars have collided in an intersection and the defendant walked out of his car and comes over to the plaintiff and says, "I'll offer you a grand to settle the matter." We already have litigation that has been ensued, and the plaintiff has filed a lawsuit against the defendant. In the aftermath of that, the defendant contacts the plaintiff and offers him $1,000 to settle the matter. It is not admissible because it's an offer to settle. There is a claim because there's been a lawsuit that's been initiated, and under the general rule, it's inadmissible. Here's another hypo. A new neighbor is bitten by Sullivan's dog. When Mr. Sullivan gets home from work, Mrs. Sullivan tells her husband that their dog bit the new neighbor. Without prior contact, Mr. Sullivan approaches the plaintiff-to-be, and I put that in quotes because that's a huge flag that is going to be relevant for reasons that you might have already found. But Mr. Sullivan approaches the plaintiff-to-be and says, quote, "Are you the fellow that was bitten by my dog? Let's sit down and let's settle." In a later lawsuit, the plaintiff offers to testify to Mr. Sullivan's admission of dog ownership and offer to settle. Is it admissible? Yes. And the reason why it's admissible in this situation is that there was no litigation at that point when Mr. Sullivan approached the plaintiff to be and said, "Are you the person who was bitten by my dog? Let's sit down and settle." So the plaintiff can, in fact, offer that admission of dog ownership and that offer to settle in the form of testimony at the trial. So again, Mr. Sullivan's admission of dog ownership and offer to settle would be admissible. Second, in order for, and second, the claim must be disputed as to either liability or amount for this exclusionary rule to operate. The claim must be disputed as to either liability or amount. So in this hypothetical, we have a defendant who says to the plaintiff, quote, I admit that I owe you the full amount of $10,000 on the note, but if you want your money, you'll have to sue me for it. On the other hand, if you want to settle now, I'll pay you $5,000 for a full release. Can the plaintiff show that the defendant admitted liability on the note? The answer is yes, because the defendant didn't dispute either the liability or the amount of the promissory note. Again, in order for the rule of exclusion to apply, the claim must be disputed as to either liability or amount. In this hypothetical, we have a defendant who admits to the plaintiff that he owes the full amount of $10,000 on the note. So the plaintiff can introduce that admission that defendant made for liability on the note. It's because the defendant did not dispute either the liability or the amount of the note. Indeed, he admitted that he owed the plaintiff the full amount of the note. Now let's compare that hypothetical to this one. In this hypothetical, the defendant says, quote, let's settle. I will admit I was negligent. Let's agree on the amount of damage. Is that admissible? No. Why? Because the admission of negligence was made as part of a settlement discussion of the disputed damage issue. So here, the situation is one where there is a where there's still yet to be a resolution of the damage, and that is still in dispute, the damage issue. And so the admission of negligence was made as part of a settlement discussion of the disputed damage issue. The defendant didn't say, I'll pay the full amount or I'll pay X number of dollars. He merely says, I'll admit I was negligent. Let's agree on the amount of damage. It's a little bit of a misnomer, and it can be very misleading here, because the statement, let's agree on the amount of damage, might suggest that there is no dispute and that there's an agreement on liability. But let's keep human nature in mind here. The fact that the defendant might say, let's agree on the amount of damage, doesn't mean that if the plaintiff turns around and says, okay, $50,000, that the defendant is going to say, okay, no problem, because I just said I would agree on the amount of damage. We all know, human nature being what it is, that while you come into something with good intentions, things break down very quickly and can go south very quickly. So we don't know. There's been no figures floated here, and we've only had a defendant who has, shown a little bit of good faith that he wants to agree, but we don't know how things are going to turn out here, because it might not go past the first 5 minutes of settlement negotiations if the defendant feels that the plaintiff is way out in left field with what his or her demand is. And it's important to recognize here that there is no severance under 408 for offers to settle. Statements made in connection with offers to settle are inadmissible. So let's take a look at this example. In a negligence action following a car accident, the defendant walks over to the plaintiff and says, quote, I'm sorry, it was my fault. I'm willing to settle this matter with you. Can the first clause, an admission that the defendant makes that it was my fault, can that be offered into evidence? Can it be severed? No, there is no severance under 408 for offers to settle. So this admission that the defendant said it was my fault would not be admissible into evidence because it cannot be severed. So the hard and fast rule here is that statements made in connection with offers to settle are inadmissible. And that's because in this example, the defendant, after he admits it was his fault, says, "I'm willing to settle this matter with you." So we have an offer to settle with an admission, but it's not admissible here. It's not admissible. Any statement of admission made in connection with an offer to settle is inadmissible. Exceptions where offers to settle may be admissible. In an example or a fact pattern where we're proving bias or prejudice of a witness. So evidence by plaintiff that the defendant's expert witness received payment to testify against the plaintiff as an offer to settle the expert's own claim against the defendant may be admissible to show bias. So I realize that that's a mouthful, but what I'm saying here is a situation where the defendant has had prior dealings with an expert witness, and as a result of those prior dealings may owe that witness money or compensation as a result of some prior work that the expert did for that defendant. The evidence that the plaintiff is trying to introduce right now is that the defendant's expert received payment to testify against plaintiff as an offer to settle the expert's own claim against the defendant. So taking this a step forward, we have a situation here where the expert witness not only has done work for the defendant in the past, but has named the defendant in a suit to recover damages, to recover money from the defendant. The evidence that expert has a suit, a claim against the defendant may be admissible to show bias because now the defendant is relying upon that expert to present evidence at the trial. Another exception here where the offer to settle may be admissible to contradict a contention of undue delay by one of the parties or to prove that a party attempted to obstruct a criminal investigation. Okay. Payment of medical and similar expenses. An offer to pay medical expenses is not admissible even though it is not a settlement offer. But if an admission of a fact accompanies a naked offer to pay hospital or medical expenses, the admission may be admitted. The effect of this is that the admission is severed. So we have like bifurcation. The admission would be severed and admitted, but the offer to pay medical expenses would be excluded. Here we have an example where the defendant says, quote, "It was all my fault. Let me pay your hospital bill." Is it admissible? Well, again, we have to separate this into two parts. "It was all my fault" as being part one. "Let me pay your hospital bill" as part two. The first clause, "It was all my fault," is admissible. And it's admissible because the admission was made as part of a naked offer to pay the medical bill. And that is not a settlement offer. Offers to plead guilty.
Esquire CLE's second verification code is DRY. DRY. All lowercase. DRY. Please take a moment and write this down. Esquire CLE's second verification code is DRY. DRY. All lowercase. DRY. Please take a moment and write this down.
Guilty, withdrawn guilty pleas, and pleas of nolo contendere are inadmissible against the individual who made the plea. And again, it's for the public policy of encouraging persons to make such pleas. Recognizing that 98% of criminal cases are resolved by way of guilty pleas helps to put this into context, because if the evidence of plea negotiations could later be used against a defendant to prove the person's guilt at a criminal trial, at a subsequent criminal trial, if the plea negotiations went south, that would completely, dampen any incentive of defendants to negotiate with the prosecutor in their case. And that would bring the criminal justice system to a screeching halt. Exceptions where offers to plead guilty may be admitted. Prosecution for perjury and for purposes of impeachment. So if, for example, a defendant gives a statement under oath and then later at trial reverses their position and states something that absolutely contradicts what they said earlier under oath in a taped, or in a courtroom, that later statement given at trial could be impeached by the earlier statement given under oath. So we need to distinguish an actual guilty plea that is not withdrawn, and an actual guilty plea that is not withdrawn is admissible as an admission in any subsequent civil action. Evidence of a final judgment entered after a guilty plea following any felony conviction is admissible under a hearsay exception. Now we're moving on to character evidence. And I see that I'm getting a little bit close to the end of my time. I do want to cover this topic, so I ask if you're willing to hang in there with me as there are some interesting fact patterns that emerge here in the character evidence field that I'd really like to share with you. So there are four preliminary questions that I like to look at when it comes to character evidence. The first is to determine the purpose for which the evidence is being offered. The second is the method of proving character. The third is what type of case are we dealing with? Is it civil or criminal? And the fourth is what trait of character is involved. If you view character evidence through these four preliminary questions, it's hard to make a mistake and to confuse overlapping rules and exceptions that are in place to the general rule. But you have to start out with these four preliminary questions: determining the purpose for which the evidence is offered. Second, what method is being used to prove character. Third, what type of case are we dealing with? And fourth, what trait of character is involved? So let's look at the first question. What is the purpose or offer of character evidence? Character, are we dealing with a situation where character is directly an issue? That's a situation where the person's character is a material element of the case. Or are we dealing with character as circumstantial evidence of a person's conduct at the time of the litigated event? That is character evidence is being used to prove conduct in conformity with character. And so we now have the trigger words for habit evidence. Or is the purpose of our offer of this character evidence to impeach the credibility of a witness? For example, is it bad character for truthfulness to impeach the credibility of a witness who testifies at trial? Next, what method or technique are we using to prove character? There are a few different possibilities. The first is specific acts of conduct. The second is opinion, personal opinion. The third is reputation in the community. And the fourth is reputation or opinion as being a red flag that tells you you're in the realm of character evidence. So very important, if we have reputation or opinion, that should basically the neon sign flashing that you're in the realm of character evidence. Next, what type of case? Is it civil or criminal? Finally, what trait of character? It must be the specific trait which is substantively in issue in the case. So let's first talk about character in civil cases. Character evidence The general rule for character in civil cases is that it is not admissible when offered as circumstantial evidence to infer conduct at the time of a litigated event. A quick and dirty hypothetical is one where the plaintiff sues the defendant for personal injury damages, alleging negligence arising out of a car accident. The plaintiff offers a witness to testify that the defendant has a reputation in the community for recklessness. Is it admissible? Of course not. Keep in mind that that is the seminal issue at trial, whether the defendant had acted recklessly in the accident on that day in question. So what the plaintiff is trying to do here is bootstrap or try to suggest that if the defendant has been reckless and careless in the past, then it's more likely that the defendant was driving his car recklessly at the time of this accident. So that is the character evidence is forbidden or prohibited inference. And that's why evidence of this type is inadmissible at a civil trial. So what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Evidence introduced by the plaintiff that the defendant has a reputation as a careful person. Introduced by the defendant that he has a reputation as a careful person is inadmissible character evidence in a negligence action. Once again, the seminal issue, the disputed issue, is the defendant's negligence at the time of the event. If we try to introduce evidence that the defendant has a reputation as a careful person, it would violate the forbidden inference, and it would tend to suggest to a jury that the defendant is not liable and was not responsible because it's character evidence that would violate the forbidden inference that the defendant was careful on the day in question at the time of the accident. Here's a hypo. The defendant seeks to testify that he has been driving for 40 years without ever being previously involved in an accident. It's not admissible. Of course, the defendant is trying to suggest that since he's always been careful before, the jury should infer that he was careful this time. Here's a hypo in a breach of warranty action. In a breach of warranty action, evidence that the seller was an honest man is an example of character evidence, which similarly would be inadmissible. Now, character evidence is admissible in a civil case when the character of a person is an essential element of a claim, defense, or cause of action. And that's because character is directly in issue. So a tip here is where knowledge of the character of another is an issue, don't be quick to assume that character is always in issue. There are such subtleties in this area that it's a minefield. Now, we have three types of cases in the civil context. There is defamation, where truth is a defense. There's negligent entrustment, and then there's wrongful death. So let's first take a look at an example of defamation where truth is a defense. In this example, Grutz calls Yuckel a crook. Plaintiff Yuckel sues defendant Grutz for defamation, seeking $1 million for damages to his reputation. The defendant, Grutz, now seeks to show that the plaintiff Yuckel has on three prior occasions stolen money from his employer. The defendant also seeks to show that even before the alleged defamation, plaintiff had a reputation for being dishonest. Is it admissible? Well, let's first take a look at some things here. This is a defamation action. Okay, so it's very important to recognize what type of civil lawsuit we're dealing with. It's a defamation action where the plaintiff is suing Grutz for defamation to his reputation because Yuckel called him a crook. What Yuckel is doing by introducing this extrinsic evidence is to prove the truth of his allegation that Yuckel was a crook. And how is he doing that? Well, he's attempting to show that on three prior occasions, plaintiff stole money from his employer. And he's also seeking to show that even before the alleged defamation, the plaintiff had a reputation for being dishonest. So what Grutz is essentially arguing is that he was truthful in his name calling of Yuckel as a crook. And is that admissible? Yes. Since the defendant's defense is truth, plaintiff's reputation before the defamatory words were spoken is critical. Now, don't get confused. Committing three larcenies is a specific act, and this is a civil case where character is an issue. Specific acts come in a civil case where character is an issue. The testimony would be admissible. Now, don't confuse this example with impeachment of witnesses. 405 deals with character evidence of parties, not impeachment of witnesses. And we're in 405 territory right now.
Now we're moving on to negligent entrustment. We're still in the area right now of character in civil cases. So let's back up for a second. What is negligent entrustment? It's a cause of action in tort law that arises where one party, who is referred to as the entrustor, is held liable for negligence because they negligently provided another party, called the entrustee, with a dangerous instrument. And the entrusted party causes injury to a third party with that same instrument. The cause of action most frequently arises where one person allows another to drive their car. However, a quick and dirty example that I think is a nice example to keep in your back in the back of your mind when you are thinking about a case involving negligent entrustment is this hypo. Let's assume that Albert owns a gun and he lends it to Bob, knowing that Bob has a propensity for violence. Albert may be held liable later on for having negligently entrusted the gun to Bob if Bob uses that gun to shoot somebody during an argument that gets out of control. So again, we have two parties here. We have Albert and then we have Bob. Albert is the owner of the gun, and so he is classified as the entrustor. Bob is the entrustee, as the one who is being lent the gun by Albert. And in this example, we also know that Albert knows something about Bob. He knows that Bob can be violent, and he subsequently is held liable during this trial for having negligently entrusted the gun to Bob, who uses that gun during an argument to shoot another person. Now, it is important to note that in the real world, while these hypotheticals are great for just laying down some of the principles, these cases in reality are hard to prove because judges and juries are less likely to find that an entrustor had a duty to check on the publicly available records of an entrustee. And that could not be more so than in a case such as this, where the entrustee was a friend. I may not have said that at the top, but in this example, Albert and Bob were friends. So as I said, in these negligent entrustment cases where the entrustor and the entrustee are friends, a lot of times judges and juries are less likely to find that the entrustor had a duty to check on the publicly available records of an entrustee. Evidence in these cases is usually presented through testimony about the entrustor's knowledge of the entrustee's reputation for violence and of specific acts or instances of violence committed by the entrustee. We have another example of negligent entrustment, and we're going to harken back to the example that comes up most frequently in these types of cases, car accident. So we have a plaintiff who is injured when Wanda drives through an intersection and collides with him while Wanda is driving the defendant's car. The plaintiff in this case is suing defendant, who is the owner of the car, under a theory of negligent entrustment. So let's first identify who the parties are here. We have the defendant, who is the one who lent Wanda the car. And so the defendant is the entrustor. Wanda, as the one who was being lent the car by the defendant, is the entrustee. So let's see here what comes up in this case. Here, the plaintiff is offering evidence that Wanda had three previous driving accidents that year. Is that testimony admissible? Well, let's go through our checklist. First, is this a civil case? Yes, it is. It's a civil case where the cause of action is negligent entrustment. Second, what are we dealing with? Well, here we're dealing with a specific act. By specific act, what I'm referring to are three previous driving accidents that Wanda had that same year. Third, character is an issue. Most certainly, Wanda's character is an issue. So let's go to the rule. A specific act where character is an issue is a proper form of character evidence. And once again, it's very important here to identify whose character we're referring to. In this situation, we're referring to Wanda's character as the entrustee. Her character is an issue in this negligent entrustment case to prove that the defendant, the entrustor, negligently loaned her his car. Now let's put a twist on these facts. Now we have the same lawsuit involving these same parties, but the defendant is now offering the testimony of her husband. And the husband is being called by the defendant to testify at trial that, in his opinion, the defendant, his wife, always inquired into a person's past driving record before loaning out her car. Let's go through our checklist here. This is opinion testimony, and it's being introduced for a very specific purpose, to establish that the defendant acted with the requisite standard of care by having inquired into Wanda's past driving, or having inquired or into a person's past driving record before loaning out her car. That is the defendant, that is the husband's testimony, that the defendant always inquired into a person's past driving record before loaning out her car. So we know that character is an issue from the prior example with Wanda, but keep in mind that it's not the defendant's character which is an issue in this case. Defendant, as we know, is the entrustor. He's the one who lent out the car to Wanda. Wanda's character is the one that's an issue. She's the one who had the accident with the defendant's car. Defendant didn't have an accident in his car. It was Wanda who had an accident in his car. Therefore, the husband's testimony would be inadmissible as character evidence. These cases are colloquially referred to as knowledge of the character of another. Now for method of proof. If character is directly in issue and therefore admissible, it may be proved by any one of the specific techniques. And we've already been going through some of those techniques in these hypotheticals. The first is specific acts, the second is opinion, and the third is reputation. Now we're going to move on to character evidence in criminal cases.
I'm going to lay out the basic rules of character evidence in criminal cases, but unfortunately, we're not going to be able to get into any hypotheticals. So we will end here with the general rule of character evidence in criminal cases. The basic rule number one, there's a few basic rules. I'm going to cover the first two here. Bad character, whether in the form of specific acts of prior misconduct, prior crimes or convictions, bad opinion or bad reputation, is not admissible by the prosecutor if the sole purpose is to show criminal disposition in order to infer guilt from disposition. Unless and until, then we go to basic rule number two, defendant opens the door. The defendant is permitted to offer evidence of good character for the pertinent trait in the form of reputation and opinion to show disposition in order to infer innocence. Only then may the prosecutor respond by showing the bad character of the accused. In other words, what we're talking about here is that the defendant in a criminal case would love to introduce evidence of his good character for the purpose of showing that he's not the type of person that would have committed this crime. And, you know, now I do have some examples in this context, but we're over time right now, and I think this is a good place for us to stop. If you have any questions, I certainly encourage you to reach out and contact me anytime. My email address is actually contained in the slide set, it is the first letter of my first name, and my middle initial, J, my last name, DeBliss, at DeBlissLaw.com. So feel free anytime if you have any questions about any of the material to shoot me an email. And I wish you the very best in navigating the minefield of Evidence 101.